Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, the people of Hong Kong stand up to Beijing.
China has not honored its promise of one country, two systems, of autonomy for Hong Kong.
The tensions in Hong Kong reveal the growing global threat from China.
He wants Congress to set up a special commission to really focus laser-like on the Chinese election meddling operation.
And with China trade issues on the table as well, we should not lose sight of China's bad and getting worse record on human rights.
It's very important that different people stand together for their common human rights, even if they have very different religious beliefs.
And Jeffrey Epstein, financier, socialite, sex offender, is now dead as a result of suicide. We'll look at the mysterious situation surrounding his death.
It's extremely unlikely that someone would have been permitted to just take his own life without someone noticing.
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can catch my program each weekday afternoon on WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin in Hong Kong, where weeks of protest escalated dramatically this week and democracy advocates shut down the airport, the fourth busiest in the world. Beijing was not pleased. To understand more fully the developments in this city of 7 million plus, we'll turn to an expert on the region, Gordon Chang. Chang was a guest of Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
With the activity that's going on in Hong Kong, my heart has gone out to the Hong Kong people in the last couple of days. I've seen videos on social media of even Hong Kong protesters singing the national anthem and waving the American flag. Exactly what's happening? Help my listeners understand.
At this moment, the Hong Kong airport terminal is quiet. But just a few hours ago, Hong Kong riot police stormed it. They did it in order to clear the place because pro-democracy protesters had blocked entrance and gates. But they also had surrounded someone who they thought was essentially a policeman dressed in protester garb. And so they tied him up and beat him. And the Hong Kong police came to his rescue. Also, there was someone who has claimed to be a Global Times reporter. Global Times is a mainland Chinese tabloid. And that person was also tied up. The protests now are the fifth day at the Hong Kong airport, but it's day two of the really big protests because the airport now has been closed down for two successive days. So this is an escalation of the situation in Hong Kong right now.
So let me ask you from a practical standpoint, what is the core beef of the protesters with, and who are they protesting? Is it the Chinese government formally? Is it the Hong Kong government not standing up to the Chinese government? What are they most enraged about?
The core grievance is that China has not honored its promise of one country, two systems, of autonomy for Hong Kong. Beijing has been encroaching on freedoms there. And what triggered the protests this time was a proposal to increase the number of jurisdictions to which Hong Kong could extradite to. And the number of additional jurisdictions included the People's Republic of China. And this enraged not only pro-democracy forces in the territory, but also the business community, because they were concerned that mainland business partners would use the extradition law to reach into the territory and grab businessmen. Basically, two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the Hong Kong population support the kids. There's been violence that the kids have used in the past. Most of the time, there's been very little comment from most people in Hong Kong. This is a dog that hasn't barked, because people in Hong Kong are not focusing in on the aggressive tactics of the kids. What they're focusing in on is the intransigence of the Hong Kong government in the form of Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive. And they've been focusing also on the brutality of the police and as well Beijing's involvement in the matter.
Okay, so it sounds like a very complicated and multifaceted type of protest. Gordon, let's shift to China momentarily. Did Donald Trump blink? Did Prime Minister Xi did he come out ahead on this? Where are we at with the tariffs and the trade war? I've been reading headline after headline over the last few days of farmers and domestic production really discouraged at where things were headed. Has it all blown up in our face?
Well, the United States had a very bad date when President Trump decided to defer tariffs on some of the consumer goods. Trump has been making the case, which I think is actually correct. China's paying and will pay the tariffs on the goods that will be tariffed. Earlier, President Trump said that he was going to impose additional 10% tariffs on $300 billion of Chinese goods. And these are basically consumer items like cell phones, toys, and the rest of it. So today he said that he was going to defer the imposing of the additional tariffs until the middle of December. And what he did was he undercut his own argument, because he's been making the argument, and I say I agree with it, that China has been absorbing the cost of the tariffs, especially with the currency devaluation that Beijing has been engaging in the last 5-6 days. But what President Trump is effectively saying by deferring the tariffs is, you know, the U.S. consumer is going to pay for them. So he's undercutting his own argument. They must be celebrating in China right now, because President Trump blinked, and I don't think he actually needed to do that.
Our concerns with China, of course, go well beyond the very legitimate concerns we have with what happens in Hong Kong. Under the leadership of Xi Jinping, China has become a growing menace and a threat. Bill Gertz, now with the Washington Free Beacon, has been tracking China's behavior closely, and he joined my program on WAVA in Washington, D.C. What can you tell us about the major player here, Guo Wenji, I guess it is, now an anti-communist dissident who's kind of waving the warning flags on this issue? What can you tell us about this man?
Yeah, Guo Wengui is a fascinating character. He's kind of a businessman slash defector who used to be an insider, and he was very close to the vice minister of state security, who is basically the main intelligence chief in China. And his sources revealed that the National Security Commission, which is the party's most powerful entity, controlled by the president, Xi Jinping, has ordered this very clear campaign by all of China's resources in their intelligence services, their diplomats, their business people. And the goal is to unseat President Trump in the 2020 election.
And of course, both President Trump and Vice President Pence have referenced this point in past speeches, haven't they?
Yes. In September, the president at the United Nations first raised the issue of China meddling in our elections. And then Vice President Pence in October issued a more detailed speech in which he quoted a senior U.S. intelligence official as saying that what Russia has done in the past to meddle in the U.S. elections pales in comparison to what China is doing. And he basically stated China's position towards Trump is that they want a different president. They want someone else who's going to be more favorable to China's views and policies.
Well, talk about, if you would, Bill, some of the, I think I said there's a four-pronged approach to this that's already well in place. In fact, I think I read in your column that this thing started back since the midterms in 2018. They've made a decision. This man, this president of the United States, cannot have another term as far as they're concerned.
Right. Well, I think from the media standpoint, the mainstream media does not need a lot of prodding. They've been vehemently anti-Trump. As for the midterm elections, according to Guo, that was when the Chinese began buying advertising supplements in major newspapers. For example, I mentioned in the story, the Des Moines Register in farm country, the China policy propaganda outlets literally bought inserts that said, oh, this is hurting farmers. And basically they were beating the drum in order to develop anti-Trump sentiment among the farm communities in the Midwest.
So they really have four prongs. The first one is Wall Street's financial leaders. Who is there that would support China's interest in this regard against our own government and the president?
Well, it seems to be a lot of, for example, Hank Paulson, who was the chairman of Goldman Sachs, has been leading the way on what I call the pro-China investment strategy. And that has been a strategy that says, look, if we just trade with China and do business with them, they'll evolve into a non-communist, benign state. And that policy has been an utter failure for the last 30-plus years, where we've had all this engagement and the Chinese have exploited it. And rather than have a more benign, non-communist China, we have a more communist China. Under Xi Jinping, he's made himself president for life. He's reverting to many of the policies of Mao Zedong, the Chinese Communist founder, but there hasn't been any change in their human rights record, their support for rogue states like Iran and North Korea. And so President Trump, again, he's mostly focused on the economic sphere, but clearly there's been a tectonic shift in U.S. policy towards China. And now, despite the fights that are ongoing here, the policy and political fights in Washington, one area where there is an emerging bipartisan consensus is on the threat from China. A lot of Democrats are joining Republicans to say, hey, no nation can survive when it's losing upwards of $500 to $600 billion a year in lost technology to China.
Another political weapon that you've alluded to, political leaders, lobbyists in Washington, that the CCP is going to enlist or has enlisted to oppose this president. I'm thinking there's been some question, although it's never been really pursued in the current Democrat side of things. Joe Biden and his son, connections of that sort, and others, maybe on both sides of the aisles, who have some long-term questionable contacts or relationships with China. Is that part of what they're playing on?
Yes, the Chinese have been literally buying up former officials, whether they're administration officials or members of Congress, and they use these people for lobbying. China also exploits corporations that are doing business in China, telling these corporations, if you want to continue to do business favorably in China, you have to lobby for us to prevent hardline policies from being implemented in the United States. So it's a major challenge. There really hasn't been a lot of research. None of the think tanks, many of which are also taking Chinese money, have not really focused on a lot of these influence activities. I address some of that in my book, War and Peace in the Information Age, which came out a couple of years ago, and it talks about how China is basically engaged in information warfare against the United States.
As I understand it, this man Guo has already been urging Congress to take action. What kind of action is he calling for?
Yeah, he wants Congress to set up a special commission to really focus laser-like on the Chinese election meddling operation. And again, it doesn't have to be limited to that, but he feels that that is the most significant threat to the upcoming 2020 election, is what China is going to be doing because of both their influence and their financial power. Again, there are concerns about Russia. I think there's been a near hysteria on the part of the liberal media in talking about Russia meddling in the election, and yet very little has been said and commented on about what's going on with China. So I feel like this article that I wrote is very important for people to understand. We've got to deal with this challenge in 2020. The government needs to take the steps to counter these activities.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
So it's very important that different people stand together for their common human rights, even if they have very different religious beliefs.
Religious liberty in China, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. As we watch events unfold in Hong Kong, and as we hear of the administration's efforts to get a trade deal with China, we should not lose sight of the fundamental rights that are at risk in Hong Kong and are bad and getting worse in China more broadly. I'm referring, of course, to religious liberty. Nathan Weininger of 21st Century Wilberforce is working faithfully on this first of human freedoms. He was my guest on The Don Crow Show. Talk about this issue with the vice president. What did they want to talk about, he and the group of multi-faith leaders? Why did they want to focus particularly on China?
Coming out of the large conference that the State Department hosted last month, convened by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and run by Ambassador for Religious Freedom Sam Brownback and his team at the IRF office there, I believe that the vice president really wanted to be able to hear and focus on these issues, particularly in China. You know, China has well over a billion people, and so the persecution that it doles out to many different believers there, including Christians, but others as well, affects a huge proportion of the population around the world. And China, of course, is a big issue not only in our trade discussions, but also in policy relating to things going on in Eastern Europe and things going on in Africa. Different leaders from different organizations, including my own, 21 Wilberforce, our president, Randall Everett, our president and founder, co-signed a letter asking for this meeting with the vice president. And their combined weight from different religious groups worked together to ask for this meeting with the vice president, and he agreed that it was important. While they were there, they requested that this issue, that human rights and religious freedom, be included as part of the trade talks with China. You know, that might sound like kind of a weird thing, but actually it was part of the normalization, the most favored nation status debate many years ago when we first granted China most favored nation trading status. We were given the argument then that if we normalized relations, their human rights record would improve. Well, actually, it's worse today than it was then. So we need to reintroduce human rights. And we think, as a religious freedom organization, religious freedom is part of that human rights package that needs to be confronted. We also asked that the vice president and the administration consider something called a tool, a policy tool in the U.S. government's toolbox called the Global Magnitsky Act sanctions. These are sanctions that allow individuals, not a whole country, but individuals who are perpetuating gross human rights violations to be targeted so that their assets are frozen, they can't move easily in international contexts, and anyone who does business with them can get slapped with very punitive sanctions as well. And we're also very interested in providing tools to the Chinese people. Right now, you are seeing Chinese people in Hong Kong stand up for their rights, rights that China agreed it would give them and started taking away as soon as it came into power in 1997 in Hong Kong. And we see Chinese people, many of them religious, many of them motivated by their religious beliefs, many of them concerned about religious freedom oppression. We see Chinese people in Hong Kong people standing up for their rights. And many people around China simply can't access that news because the Chinese government is blocking them from seeing it. Yet we have the tools in this country to ensure that they can see it, that they can get access to the internet. So why aren't we deploying those tools? So we encourage the vice president to help open those floodgates of information so that the Chinese people can see what the Communist Party doesn't want them to see.
Now, we know that rats and rodents love the dark. They scurry away from the light. And is it not true that dictatorial nations, whether it be China or some other egregious violators through the years, they hate this kind of international attention, especially when it comes to the level it is with the presidency, the vice presidency, and other well-known leaders in the world of social issues and activism? They don't like this kind of light shined on them, do they?
They can't stand it, which is exactly why we need to keep shining it on them. You know, China is an amazing civilization with amazing resources, with amazing opportunities to be a truly responsible leader on the global stage. And this violation of their own people's rights is completely undermining that. And we need to highlight that this is not the best path forward for the Chinese people or for China as a nation.
Talk about something that also you may have alluded to already, but I understand out of this a new coalition is forming. And how is this different from past efforts to really focus in on China's egregious violations?
Well, you know, in the past, we've had different organizations or different religious groups really try and highlight the concerns from their particular community. And those concerns need to be highlighted. As a Christian, I'm very concerned about the violence that's happening against house churches that's escalating, churches being shut down. A few years ago, we had pastors who were literally being bulldozed while they were in their homes, and their homes were being destroyed. And I'm very concerned about those issues. But some of those same tactics that they were practicing on the Tibetan Buddhists several years ago, they're now using on the Uyghur Muslims. And according to our contacts on the ground there, they're now using those same tactics in digital technologies that were targeting Uyghur Muslims. They're now using that on house church leaders and official churches as well. And so it's very important that different people stand together for their common human rights, even if they have very different religious beliefs.
Elsewhere in the news, I'm sure many of you saw this headline, Jeffrey Epstein dead in suicide at jail, spurring inquiries. That was from the New York Times, but there were scores more of similar stories announcing the death of the financier and convicted sex offender. He was, we know, facing serious charges and a very serious effort for him to actually pay a real price for his crimes. Something more than the 13 months he served after a plea deal for sex crimes committed against underage women in 2008. So, how is it that he could so quickly end up dead? If something seems amiss to you, you're not alone. Judith Miller, formerly of the New York Times and certainly no conservative, was astounded. It was, in her words, writing for the City Journal, particularly unfathomable and outrageous. Here she is with Kevin McCullough.
You say that it's next to impossible to kill oneself in jail, and you say, I know because I've been there. Why does this death seem so suspicious to you, Judy Miller?
Well, having been incarcerated for 3 months at the Alexandria Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia, which was, it's a very high security state-run jail, I was protecting the First Amendment. I was not accused of a crime.
I was
protecting my sources. But I'm very aware of how jails and prisons and detention centers work. And they are places where there is no such thing as privacy, and where security, and especially the security of prisoners, is kind of the number one priority. It's just extremely unlikely, given the way these places operate, that someone would have been permitted to, especially someone so high profile, to just take his own life without someone noticing. But I have to say, something terrible happened at this facility. And it either happened because the place is so overburdened and so poorly staffed that this is incompetence on a scale I've never seen, or someone was either paid to look the other way, and it wasn't accidental, but it was intentional. Either way, either explanation is really appalling. And I think that's why Attorney General Bill Barr is so, as in his words, you know, appalled.
Let me ask you, in terms of the response that you're seeing from the Justice Department, is there anything about how they've responded thus far? And to be specific, Barr said not only will the FBI look into it, but also the Inspector General. Do you feel like there's anything that the feds aren't doing that they should be or should be doing differently in terms of responding to this death?
No, I think they're doing exactly the right thing. I think Bill Barr is doing exactly the right thing.
The Christian Outlook Podcast, brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com. Coming up, are we becoming reluctant Christian witnesses?
The Christians among us who are having lots of spiritual conversations, they're just starting up a trailhead of a conversation to see where God may take it.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. As we watch the world changing so quickly around us today, I imagine there are many of you who share my conviction. What we need is Christ. What this nation needs is a spiritual awakening, renewal, or revival. The problem is, as the research from our next guest confirms, there are simply too few of us talking about our faith at all. Don Everts is the author of The Reluctant Witness, Discovering the Delight of Spiritual Conversations. He joined my colleague, Georgine Rice, on KPDQ in Portland.
Talk a little bit about the work that was most recently done and how that helps us better understand where we stand in our culture, as well as moving us forward in terms of how to engage in these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, great. So Lusernauer and Barna, they did a study 25 years ago. And then in 2018, they did a nationwide survey, qualitative, quantitative, all these really, really smart people at Barna who know how to do this, to find out kind of what's the state of our spiritual conversations. And there was really sobering findings that really caught us up short. And there were really hopeful findings as well that gave us great hope for the cause of the kingdom of God in our own time. So let me give you an example, Georgine.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really sobering findings was that 3/4 of all Christians in the United States have 9 or fewer spiritual conversations every year. And remember, I'm not talking about witnessing conversations where a Christian is, you know, summarizing the gospel for a non-Christian. Any spiritual conversation with anyone at all, 9 or fewer a year, that's 3/4 of all Christians. That's stunning. We also found out that when we do talk about our faith, particularly with non-Christians, We bring up the Bible less. We bring up the benefits of being a follower of Jesus less. And we bring up other people's beliefs and how they interact with the truths of the gospel less.
You begin in the introduction of your book, The Reluctant Witness, with a story when you were an intern about a trip on an airplane in which you were reading a book on evangelism and your experience in just wrestling with whether or not you should engage in conversation with a person you were seated next to. Can you recall that for our listeners?
Oh, yeah. I wish it was an airplane. It was actually a bus.
A bus.
It was a much longer. It was a 15-hour bus ride. And, you know, the sad truth is for 13 and a half hours, I didn't say a word to the person in the seat right next to me. And that whole while I was reading a book about evangelism, about how much our God loves people and wants to reach out to people and how he calls us to be a part of that work with him. And I'm an introvert. I am a reluctant witness. And after 13 and a half hours, it was too much. And I just turned, I was convicted, and I said, hi. After 13 and a half hours. And incredible things actually transpired over the next hour and a half in the conversation. But that story has really reminded me of a couple things. One, that God really is into people, and he really does call us to interact with them. And if we just turn and say hi, you never know what might happen. And the other thing it really encourages me of is if God can take someone like me, you know, so reluctant, so shy, so hesitant to talk, and he can bring me to a place where I've been able to talk with people about everyday things and also about the faith, then there's hope for anyone.
Mm. I think there might be something of a misunderstanding about what we are called to, the, you know, bringing good news. It's not a one-sided conversation in which in the space of 3 to 5 minutes, you've given the four spiritual laws, you've given your entire testimony, and then press them to make some kind of decision. I love the idea of a spiritual conversation in which you engage someone. It's a two-way conversation. And in the natural course of things, because your faith is your life, it becomes a part of that conversation.
That's right, Georgine. And 3/4 of us are not talking about our faith much at all. But 1/4 of all Christians, and this is part of the hopeful thing, are having lots of spiritual conversation. And the data folks took those 1/4 of the respondents, 1/4 of all Christians, and they kind of broke down the data. You know, is there anything unique about those folks? And one of the indications in the findings was that they are open to kind of graciously adapting to where their conversation partner is, what their spiritual posture is. In other words, they are less likely to have like a memorized gospel summary. And every time they're in a conversation with a non-Christian, they kind of puke out that summary, you know, kind of, whether it's awkward, whether it fits in the conversation or not. Reluctant conversationalists are actually more likely to do that, which may tell us why they don't have many conversations, because they think that's what it means. Eager conversationalists, the Christians among us who are having lots of spiritual conversations, they adapt to where their conversation partner is, and they're open to see what God does. They're not trying to force it. They are really responsive to where their conversation partner is. And that is really hopeful and I think encouraging for the rest of us, that we can kind of, it breaks down some of these myths of what evangelism really is. And, you know, I have to summarize the gospel. That has to be the first word out of my mouth, and I have to force them to, you know, accept it. Well, no, nothing like that. In fact, the folks who are having fruitful, regular, joyful conversations, they're just starting up the trailhead of a conversation to see where God may take it.
For the complete interview with Don Everetts on spiritual conversations, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, are you confident in the faith about which you're having conversation?
Atheists try and use reason to say God doesn't exist, yet reason wouldn't exist unless there's a mind that grounds the laws of logic.
Frank Turek when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Our guest in the last segment, Don Everetts, did well in his challenge for us to open the door to spiritual conversations. But one challenge or one hindrance many people face is what we could call the erosion of confidence in our faith, the result of the onslaught of attacks from an increasingly hostile world. Can the claims of Christianity hold up against the proud and loud atheists? The answer from apologist and author Frank Turek is an unequivocal yes. In fact, they need God to make their case. Turek explained on the Eric Metaxas Show.
It was a revelation to me that there was so much evidence, and I thought, how have I missed this? Because it's so clear, it's so obvious, and there's so much of it.
Yeah, you would never send your son or daughter into battle unarmed, in a real battle, with guns. But we send our kids off to college unarmed intellectually. We just say, have faith. And when they go there, the professor tries to give them reasons why their supposed faith is wrong. And the kids are unarmed. They can't handle it. That's why 75% of young people who are Christians, going to church as Christians, walk away from the church once they go to college. That's why we wrote Stealing from God.
I know that. And it's an amazing thing. That's why it just thrills me that you are out there on college campuses. I like this concept of why atheists need God to make their case, because in Western culture, we're operating with a lot of assumptions, and people have this anger about God or whatever. And all those assumptions are effectively Christian Western assumptions. And so already when people are attacking God, they're using stuff that they got from a Christian culture.
Sure. Well, science came from a Christian culture because the early scientists believed that the world was orderly because God created and sustains it. How can we even do science if the world wasn't orderly or repetitive or consistent? We couldn't. When we're doing science, we're trying to figure out what particular cause caused a particular effect. And it seems the best explanation for why we have orderly, consistent, precise natural laws is because there's a mind that set it up that way and keeps it going that way. And in fact, I think it was either Newton or it was one of the early scientists who said that when he's looking at how the planets go, he's thinking God's thoughts after him.
That he's thinking God's thoughts after him. Mm-hmm. Whoa. Well, a lot of the greatest scientists have had that spooky feeling at some point where they just think there's something scary here. Like it really seems like there has to be a mind.
In fact, there was a guy that you may have quoted. I don't know if you quoted in your Wall Street Journal article on fine tuning. I've quoted him several times. His name is Fred Hoyle.
Fred Hoyle. He invented the term Big Bang.
He did. Yeah. Do you remember what he said? He said something like this. I'm trying to remember the exact quote. He said, "An honest look at the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, biology, and chemistry, and there are no blind forces we're speaking about in nature." Right. And he was an atheist.
He was an atheist. Yeah. And it really, so he really struggled because here was a man who was able to see that it didn't really make sense that this was random. Like it didn't make sense, and it troubled him because again, it sort of seems spooky. Like you look at it and you go, you know what? It sure seems like somebody was here. It seems like, you know, it's like looking at Mount Rushmore and saying, like, I think maybe the wind created that. It's like the odds are pretty, you know, in an infinity of universes, you're never going to get a Mount Rushmore created by the wind.
That's right.
And here you have these scientists like Fred Hoyle who they've looked at things that most of us will never think about. And they get this creepy feeling like it really looks like someone smarter than me by far made this. But I can't believe that. I don't want to believe that.
My friend John Lennox, who's a brilliant Oxford philosopher.
Is the best.
And
he's
I know
best.
You've had him on Socrates in the
times.
City.
Yeah.
He said this. He asked his scientific friends who are atheists. He says, how do you do science? And they normally talk about some kind of apparatus. He goes, no. I mean, how do you do science up here? And they normally say, you mean with my mind? And then they stop themselves. Brain? Because they don't believe in the mind. And he says, yeah, tell me where the brain came from. And usually they'll say, well, my brain is the product of an unintelligent process, a blind process that didn't have its end in mind. And Lennox will stop and say, and you trust it?
I've heard him do that, and it's so funny. It's always funnier when he does it because he has that Irish lilt,
yes,
brogue.
Yeah.
But it's true. If you ask a scientist, yes, how do you trust your ability to think rationally? Mm-hmm. So you've concluded there's no God. Okay, with what do you do that? And they say, well, with my brain. And then, you have to be logical. You have to say, okay, how did your brain get there? And they really believe that it was the result of random forces, random mutations over time with no purpose, whatever. And and then his punchline, and so you trust.
In fact, Lennox, he says this to them: suppose your computer could be put together by random forces, would you trust anything it told you?
Yeah.
Of course not. So I mentioned earlier in the book Stealing from God, we have this acronym, CRIME, CRIMES. The R stands for reason, and the point we just made deals with the fact that atheists try and use reason to say God doesn't exist, yet reason wouldn't exist unless there's a mind that grounds the laws of logic and grounds our ability to do reason. So when they're saying I have reasons to believe God doesn't exist, they're actually stealing from God to argue against him. And as you know, the other side of this is that many of these atheists today, Eric, are materialists. They think everything's made of molecules. They think we're just moist robots, right?
That's disgusting. We'll edit that out.
And so for moist robots, why should they believe anything they think, including the thought there's no God?
Yeah.
Because that thought, according to their own theory, got there because of the laws of physics. They arrived there because of the laws of physics, not because they're reasoning, not because they have a real mind and can follow the evidence where it leads.
Right.
So reason is a thing they use to say God doesn't exist, but they have to steal it from God to say he doesn't exist.
I mean, that has to infuriate some people. I know you've debated a lot of atheists, and I think that they would take umbrage at the idea.
I've asked them all the question they never answer. I asked Michael Shermer the same question. If you're just a molecular machine, because you're a materialist, if you're a moist robot, why should we believe a thing you say, or why should you believe a thought you have? And he just made a joke. He said, oh, yeah, just electric me. He wouldn't answer the question because there is no answer.
Right.
There's no answer.
That's what I love, is that there is no answer. Mm-hmm. And if you watch these debates, I mean, the funny thing is that a lot of people, the way they get out of this is by not being logical. In
yes.
other words, they can't understand what you logically said, or they just wave it away because it annoys them. But they can't really logically refute it.
Well, you know who was an atheist who broke the code on this recently is right here in New York, NYU. Thomas Nagel wrote the book Mind and Cosmos, How the Neo-Darwinian View of the Universe is Almost Certainly False. He said, materialism can't explain why or how we can think. And I've got a real problem with that. Now, he doesn't want to go to God. He doesn't want to go to theism, but he realizes materialism doesn't work either. So you have some atheists admitting this is a big problem.
Coming up,
from one argument, we get a being that's spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, and intelligent.
More with Frank Turek when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Sometimes the work for the Christian apologist and even the work of evangelism can be wrongly characterized as an effort to argue someone into the kingdom. That is, if we can just answer the objections and demonstrate the historical veracity of the person of Jesus Christ and the overwhelming evidence for his resurrection from the dead, he or she would just yield to Christ. We know it's not that simple. Frank Turek knows it's not that simple. Here he is again with Eric Metaxas.
Intellectually, it does seem like a slam dunk.
How is it reasonable to say if something were true, you wouldn't believe it? Well, reason isn't the problem. The problem isn't here. The problem's here. They don't want it to be true.
It's the will, right?
Yeah, they don't want there to be a God because they want to be God of their own lives. You see, most people are not on a truth quest. You know what we're on? We're on a happiness quest.
People wisely know that there's more to truth than syllogisms and facts. Mm. You may have just never heard this kind of stuff, right? So what are some of the arguments or things that you say to people?
Well, for God. Okay. Well, one argument for God is the fact that the universe exploded into being out of nothing. And even atheists are admitting this. If space, time, and matter literally had a beginning, whatever caused space, time, and matter can't be made of space, time, and matter. In other words, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create, because impersonal forces don't choose anything. You know, gravity doesn't choose to pull this cup to the ground if I drop it. It just does it. To create, you got to make a choice. The being would also have to be intelligent in order to make a choice. And so from one argument, we get a being that's spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, and intelligent.
Another argument that people put up against God, there is extraordinary evil and suffering in the world. And so I think a lot of people legitimately have the question. They say, well, how can you explain a loving God with things like that happening?
To give the philosophical answer, evil actually shows God does exist, because there would be no such thing as evil unless there was good, and there'd be no such thing as good unless God existed, because what we mean by good is God's nature. So if evil exists, God exists. Evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God, because evil wouldn't even exist unless good exists. And because evil, we can put it this way, and evil is like cancer. If you take all the cancer out of a body, you've got a better body. If you take all the body out of the cancer, you've got nothing. See, evil doesn't exist on its own. It can only exist in a good thing. So if we're going to say something's evil, we're presupposing good. You can look at it this way, too. We've got lights in here. The shadows prove the sunshine. In other words, you can have sunshine without shadows, but you can't have shadows without sunshine. You can't have evil without good.
I'm doing the best I can.
When right. they say best I can, they're saying I'm trying to get close to the standard of good,
right.
and that standard of good is God's nature. Think about how evil our thoughts are. I mean, we may restrain ourselves, thankfully, but we're still evil. It's much easier to be bad than good.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.